provide a decent standard of living for tip workers?
I guess I would just say it's important that we look at our current wage standards and think about the history of where they came from and look at the current harms that they're inflicting on workers and think about how we can holistically get rid of all of these carve-outs, exemptions, and lower standards. Because when we have these lower standards for certain classes of workers, it really encourages exploitation and inequitable treatment of workers. And so I think it's really important that we raise the standards for some of these workers who are paid less, at least to the minimum wage that other workers are being paid, and then also raise the standards for all of these workers so that they are being paid an adequate wage, receiving adequate benefits, and really just being able to have a basic standard of economic security.
Well, Nina Mast, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Policy for the People. We will see you next time.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11. Here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. So please join in on this month's Invitational. Today, Jeff Gonsol takes a look at Fellini's short film, Toby Dammit, based on an Edgar Allan Poe short story. And friend of the show, Stephen Hood, drops in to evaluate the career of Vincent Price. But first, we again welcome acting coach Kurt Conroy to discuss the new film from Pedro Almodovar, Strange Way of Life. Welcome once again to Kurt Conroy, who is an acting coach in Portland, Oregon, and he's here to talk to us, or talk with us, about the new Pedro Almodovar film, Strange Way of Life.
Years ago, you asked me what two men could do living together on a ranch. I'll answer you now.
In brief, what did you think of it?
You know, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very stylish in a lot of ways. I think of a lot of his films are really packed with history, bit of suspense, mystery, and it's really focused on relationship.
That's true. It's a Western. It was shot in the Spanish region where Sergio Leone shot many of his Westerns. It's only, about 30 minutes long? And I guess it is his take on movie with Heath Ledger. I'm having a brain freeze.
Brokeback Mountain.
Brokeback Mountain, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then his reply to it, or his answer to it. And it's
a bit of an antidote to it.
Antidote, yeah.
Yeah.
For such a short film, it certainly goes in unexpected directions in terms of the plot and what happens to the people.
Exactly. And they actually make an allusion to Brokeback Mountain in it. And I feel like it was on purpose. Do you remember the part where he comes in and it's a rendezvous between these two who haven't seen each other, but after the sex happens, he was talking about how his back was broke. And he's like, your back is broke. Do you remember that part?
Yeah, now I do. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the movie stars Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal as two men who've led somewhat separate lives, but had a relationship in the past and renew it in the now of the movie under really stressful circumstances.
Yeah, I don't think that's revealed until after the rendezvous the next morning.
Right.
So they hadn't seen each other for, I believe, 25 years, and they're coming back. And then there's another reason why Pedro Pascal Silva, is that the character's name?
I really like Pedro Pascal. He is so appealing and so real at the same time. And Ethan Hawke, he's pretty darn good in this film, too. Not only does it have a really fascinating and unpredictable story, but it's beautifully shot. And you would assume from a movie that comes from the House of Saint Laurent, it's also very well dressed and costumed. You know,
it's the wardrobe is beautiful. And it's very stylish, too. I was telling you this. It reminded me a little bit of the movie with Colin Firth, A Single Man, directed by Tom Ford, which I think was his directorial debut. I might be wrong on that. But how stylish it was. The use of like a lot of models and fashion, and really setting up the art, the style of it.
That was Tom Ford's first film, an adaptation of the Christopher Isherwood novel about a day in the life of a guy that who's an academic. In any case, I love the way these guys are dressed. I mean, they're in the middle of the desert, and in a real Western, they would be filthy and stinky, but here they just look very elegant, well-coiffed, and appealing.
There's a real attention to the wardrobe and the clothes, especially with Ethan Hawke's character when he's putting on his shirt and his tie before he gets ready to go. The colors and the vibrancy, and the younger Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal, you know, were these very young, handsome, beautiful models. Like, try not to give away. It's 30 minutes, but a lot happens.
Exactly.
And it was like, oh, okay. I also think of going back to what you said about Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke, to me, my memories of Ethan Hawke are from Dead Poets Society.
Oh, yes, that's right.
He plays a closeted character, right, that gets into theater. He's inspired by the Robin Williams, the English teacher character at the prep school. There's like a very wonderful, beautiful sensitivity to both Pedro Pascal and Ethan Hawke as actors. And it's like nice coming back to this, I think.
That's right. That's a good connection. I forgot that he was the sensitive kid whose father doesn't understand him. And the movie never comes out and expresses directly that he's gay or closeted gay. But I mean, it's pretty obvious from the way the story goes.
Yeah. And as far as we're not sure, but he's not accepted by his very, very like austere, probably kind of conservative father's kind of.
Right. Not unlike the Kevin Spacey movie played by.
American Beauty.
American Beauty. Yes. Thank you. Excuse me. So how do you think this film fits into Almodovar's recent films? For example, we both really liked Parallel Mothers, which was his previous film, but here this is a short film. Do you think it's going to get paired with something, maybe The Human Voice, which is another short film that he made a little bit earlier, or do you think, as I do, that all movies should be 30 minutes long from now on? The constraint of the time really helps concentrate your mind as a viewer, and maybe the director too, in terms of this very rich, dense story happening. It doesn't happen fast, but so much happens in it, as you say. At the same time, it feels like a feature film. There's moments that are packed with action, and then there's languorous moments where we're just contemplating these two friends.
I don't know. I feel like as a filmmaker, he holds a string really tight and just plucks it a little bit along the way, because it's always like a little bit of mystery about what's happening with the
story. That's really true in Parallel Mothers too, because he forces you to pay attention to the characters and their unexpected decisions and drives and with whom they hook up, etc. But I don't get much of the sense of the politics in this film, unless it's sexual politics or gender politics, unlike Parallel Mothers, which is a very strong look back on the Spanish Civil War, for example.
Yeah, I think there's certain politics in this of Ethan Hawke's character being a sheriff of this small town in the Wild West, of having to be dutiful to this, and Pedro Pascal being, there's politics of me being a father and me having to do my fatherly duties to protect my son. albeit we're kind of spoiling it.
Yeah, but yes, yeah, key point. Yes, paternity and maternity really figure a lot in his films, now that you mention it.
Yeah, I don't think it's as political as Parallel Mothers that right. way, but there is a lot of politics. And then, like I said, I think it's still really based off of a relationship that is complicated and complex.
Exactly.
Someone were lovers 25 years ago, and they were friends, but now someone needs to do their duty as a sheriff, and someone else is obligated as a father to protect their son. There's the conundrum.
Yeah, it is. And the resolution of that conundrum is, at least to my eyes, really fascinating and unexpected. It's just different.
It's a little bit like sweet and loving, but also like a little bit whatever happened to Baby Jane in a certain way. Have you seen the film? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah. And well, I thought of that with the very end when he's like, we're going to be companions, in that scene at the very end with whatever happened to Baby Jane, where she's like, you mean we could have been friends?
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh. Well, we've been talking with Kurt Conroy, who's an acting coach here in Portland. Hey, do you have any notes for the actors?
I thought they were great. Good job.
Excellent.
I thought Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal were great. I think there was a kind of a sensational part with them as younger people and the younger people. I just thought they were very, very beautiful people. And I think that's kind of what they were going for, to
exactly,
kind of
yes.
spice it up a little bit.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, thanks for talking to us about this film, Kurt. And we will be happy to have you back very soon about another movie. Now let's turn to Jeff on Fellini.
In the European cinema of the 50s and 60s, especially in France and Italy, it was common to see the anthology or omnibus film. Three or more separate stories, perhaps with a theme connecting them, often featuring major stars and directed by different directors. There was Love at 20, featuring the second in the Antoine Doinel cycle, directed by François Truffaut and featuring Jean-Pierre Lude. Antonioni, Godard, Rossellini, and Fellini all had contributed to omnibus films. If nothing else, it afforded directors a chance to work in the short form and to develop ideas that didn't require a feature film. And in 1967, producers Alberto Grimaldi and Raymond Eggier developed the idea for an omnibus film based on the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. Some of the directors announced to be contributing to the project were Luchino Visconti, Claude Chabrol, Joseph Losey, even Orson Welles. None of them ultimately came to participate in the film, which was called Histoire Extraordinaire when it was released in France in 1968, and Spirits of the Dead in the U.S., released in 1969, with an English dubbing and a narration by Vincent Price. Instead, the three segments came to be directed by Roger Vadim, Louis Malle, and the third, and by far the best one, by Federico Fellini. Based on Poe's story, Never Bet the Devil Your Head, only the very end of the story is used. Instead, Toby Dammit becomes a totally original and quintessential Fellini nightmare. Placed as it is in his filmography between Juliet of the Spirits and Satyricon, you have a Fellini who was fully diving into his dream world for inspiration. Juliet being his first color film, Fellini was now exploring his full visual palette. His penchant for highly artificial art direction and his satirical take on contemporary life, and especially celebrity, are very much in evidence in this mini masterpiece. With music by Nino Rota and cinematography by Giuseppe Rotunno, this is a full-on Fellini film. In Toby Dammit, Terence Stamp stars as a former Shakespearean actor slipping into alcoholism and excess. Jaded and cynical, he's been lured to Rome to star in a spaghetti western in exchange for a Ferrari as a bonus. Lurching through sometimes hallucinatory settings, Dammit begins having visions of a macabre girl with a white ball. Getting increasingly drunk at a film awards ceremony, he appears to be slowly losing his mind. After being forced to give a speech, he gets his aforementioned Ferrari and starts racing around Rome, which appears more and more surreal. Is he racing away from something or ever closer to his fate? And who is this demonic little girl whom he has earlier identified in a TV interview as his idea of the devil? Racing lost in this bizarre landscape, he eventually crashes through a work zone and comes to a stop at the site of a collapsed bridge. As if beckoning in the distance is the little girl and the white ball. Dammit races toward the void across the ravine. The Ferrari disappears as we slowly see a view of the roadway with a thick wire across it, dripping with blood. The girl reappears and picks up the decapitated head of Toby Dammit as the sun rises over this bizarre scene from hell. As wonderful as this little Fellini gem is, it has generally been pretty hard to find, buried as it is in this Spirits of the Dead Histoire Extraordinaire omnibus. But in 2019, Toby Dammit was beautifully restored in Italy from a 35mm inner negative made available by Alberto Grimaldi Productions. And this can be seen for free on YouTube or streaming on the Criterion channel. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And don't forget to drop into Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for more recommendations. And you are listening to Film with 11 here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today and know that your pledge of membership to KBOO helps keep our database tip-top. Finally, we welcome Stephen Hood to look at a few key films featuring Vincent Price.
Welcome,
Stephen Hood, back to the show. I want a few questions. You know, it's almost Halloween, and when that time comes around each year, one's mind drifts naturally to the dulcet tones of Vincent Price.
And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver, for no mere mortal can resist.
And I know that you are like Tim Burton now. You're a big fan of Vincent Price.
Of the two Vincent Price movies that I watched recently, I am becoming more and more of a fan and looking forward to watching the rest of his filmography.
Which two did you see?
The first Vincent Price film that I watched several years ago was The Raven from 1963 directed by Roger Corman. Uh-huh. And I came across that one, I think, just randomly scrolling on one of the streaming services.
Are you some dark-winged messenger from beyond? Answer me, monster, tell me truly. Shall I ever hold again that radiant maiden whom the angels call Lenore?
How the hell should I know? What am I, a fortune teller? Ooh, I'm chilled to the bones. Why don't you give me some wine?
And I recently became aware of Peter Lorre and saw that he was in the film. And very much enjoyed the use of practical effects. The very campy set designs, the shoestring budgets. And last week, I asked my girlfriend to watch The Raven with me so she could watch the very popular final battle between Vincent Price and Boris Karloff, because I was a very big fan of the use of practical effects the first time I watched this film, and it was just as enjoyable the second time.
Excellent. That's The Raven. And then you just recently saw
it. It was the Comedy of Terrors, the Jacques Tornier film, which both films are written by Richard Matheson, but have different directors. And short of the directors being different, almost everybody else seems to be from the same team, had the same special effects, same director of photography, same costume design, same sound, same music coordinator.
Did Crosby do the cinematography for both?
Yes, Floyd Crosby, probably best known for working with Murnau, I believe was his first film as a director of photography. I think he won the Oscar for... He also was the cinematographer on High Noon, and you get a vastly different a sense of tension. Even though Roger Corman probably wishes he could build the tension that High Noon builds.
So what's so good about Vincent Price?
What I like most about Vincent Price is how over the top he is in these films. In The Raven, he plays a hesitant sorcerer, almost akin to Gene Wilder's character in Young Frankenstein, where his father was a very famous sorcerer, and he acts as if he doesn't want anything to do with being a sorcerer, but he secretly is very, very adept at it. And he gets... you know, thrust into a larger story surrounding his dead wife and relationships that his father had created before he passed, 20 years before the film takes place, as a result of Peter Lorre, also a sorcerer, seeking out Vincent Price's very over-the-top Dr. Craven to help him get revenge against Boris Karloff's character.
Well, don't just stand there gaping at me.
That voice, I...
Will you give me some wine?
Surely this is a dream.
Hurry up, will you?
There you are.
Mmm. I like that. Mmm.
Upon my soul.
Never mind your soul. Start concentrating on getting me back to my rightful form.
Your rightful form?
Well, what do you think? I was born this way?
Well, I have it. You are under an enchantment.
Took you long enough to find that out.
Peter Lorre plays the Raven as a result of a magic duel gone wrong for Peter Lorre. And so the Raven... being a reference to Edgar Allan Poe is
tenuous at best.
It's a tenuous connection in order to, I think, take advantage of Poe's notoriety. And from my understanding, the Matheson scripts were very, very slapdash, you know, maybe a couple days to put together. And I had heard a quote that, and I'm not remember who said it, but that like Roger Corman, with the Roger Corman Edgar Allan Poe films, it was Poe made the first reel and Corman made the second reel.
That's good. The first one, I think, was The Fall of the House of Usher, and that fairly closely follows the short story. And then later, The Mask of the Red Death kind of follows the short story, but also inserts another story. But it is widely considered one of the best of the Poe, Corman, and Vincent Price adaptations. I think they did 8 in all.
Yes, I think it was 8. I know that there was supposed to be a sequel to the other film I watched, Comedy of Terrors, but it did so bad at the box office and was so panned by critics that they quickly scrapped the idea of a sequel.
That makes sense. What is Comedy of Terrors about?
Comedy of Terrors is almost identical cast to The Raven. Jack Nicholson is not in Comedy of Terrors, and it has a different female love interest, although whose love interest it is in Comedy of Terrors plays a major part in the story. And in Comedy of Terrors, Vincent Price plays an alcoholic who's married into a undertaker's family. The patriarch of the family is played by Boris Karloff. Boris Karloff was meant to play a different character, but his inability to undertake the strenuousness of the role kept him acting from a chair through the entirety of Comedy of Terrors. A similar situation with the Raven. When he's not, you know, slowly walking through frame, he's seated in a chair. Boris Karloff is also not the only actor in both of these films who was towards the end of their careers. You see the health effects really plaguing on Peter Lorre's character as well. Mm. I know that he suffered from drug addiction and alcoholism through most of his adult life. And I think The Comedy of Terrors is his third to last film. He would die a year after its release in 1964.
Yeah, I think his last movie was a beach blanket bingo type comedy.
It was either that or the Patsy.
The Jerry Lewis movie?
The Jerry Lewis film. I'm not sure. Those both came out in 64. I can't remember which one was Peter Lorre's last.
Halloween is coming up. Would you recommend our listeners give Vincent Price a chance for a Halloween night marathon?
I feel that these are very fun movies to put on if you have friends over who are unfamiliar with Vincent Price. If you have friends who are familiar with Vincent Price, of course, these are great films to return to. They're very low budget. You will recognize what makes AIP so famous for making films. They were able to take, you know, multiple teams working on the same film in different locations, slap it all together and try to come up with a cohesive story within, you know, 2 weeks of it would take them to make a film. And there's a lot of heart in every aspect of these films. While they're limited, Corman was famous for having almost zero budget and then finding a way to cut corners on that budget. And
he did have a passion for cinema. I mean, he made a lot of movies.
And he did.
The weight of attention on him should start to shift away from his role as a producer to his role as a director, and look at some of the subject matter of his films, and some of them are really quite good. For example, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which is almost like a documentary. It is just lays out the story, and it's an accurate account of the events of that particular gangland crime. If we look at him and his fascination with Poe, you really see some very deep and interesting obsessions, for example, with marriage and family heritage and things like that.
Yeah, I saw a few comparisons between Corman and Poe in the sense that they worked in very tight budgetary and time constraints in order to create these masterpieces. And just as Poe was considered a bit of a hack in his time, I'm hoping that there's a resurgence in both Roger Corman and Vincent Price as being recognized for what they were able to accomplish with very, very little, because they cared so much about making film and offered many opportunities for future film creators that have garnered much prestige, like Coppola and Dennis Hopper.
Well, we've been talking to Stephen Hood about Vincent Price, and we're both encouraging our listeners sit down and have a Vincent Price marathon, particularly with Roger Corman Poe series, in which Vincent Price appears in almost all of them, I think. So anyway, thank you, Stephen, and we hope to have you back on soon. And thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
I'm Grace Gearing, Medicine Eagle Reed. I am broadcasting.